Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Lee is Trapped and Must Be Taken, 11 Fateful Days After Gettysburg, July 4th to July 14th, 1863, by Thomas J. Ryan and Richard R. Schaus. Narrated by David Stifel. Prologue. After reviewing Thomas J. Ryan's masterful five-part series titled A Battle of Wits, Intelligence Operations During the Gettysburg Campaign, published in Gettysburg Magazine from 2003 to 2005, I concluded this was the best explanation I have read about the role of intelligence in the confrontation between General Robert E. Lee's Army of Northern Virginia and Major General Joseph Hooker's Army of the Potomac, later under the command of Major General George G. Meade, during the lengthy Gettysburg Campaign in 1863. I found each part of this series progressively more informative than the previous one. Ryan's background as a senior intelligence officer for the Department of Defense provided the knowledge and experience necessary to interpret the role of Colonel George H. Sharp as Chief of the Army of the Potomac's Bureau of Military Information, BMI. Ryan's work was a continuation of the pioneering study published by Edwin C. Fischel in 1996, titled The Secret War for the Union, The Untold Story of Military Intelligence in the Civil War. The information that the BMI provided to Meade during the battle, mainly derived from interrogation of prisoners of war, provided Meade with a better understanding of the strength and condition of Lee's army than General Lee knew himself. In concluding the five-part series, Ryan stressed that timely and accurate intelligence cannot affect the outcome of a battle unless it is coupled with resolute leadership. These Gettysburg Magazine articles formed the basis for Ryan's award-winning book, Spies, Scouts, and Secrets in the Gettysburg Campaign, How the Critical Role of Intelligence Impacted the Outcome of Lee's Invasion of the North, June to July 1863, published by Savas Beatty in 2015. Perceiving a need to expand on the analysis of the period subsequent to the three-day battle, during which Lee's Army of Northern Virginia retreated from Gettysburg, Ryan joined with co-author Richard R. Schaus to research and write about the decisions Lee and Meade made during Lee's desperate attempt to reach safety across the Potomac River after the defeat of his army at Gettysburg. On the fateful day of September 11th, 2001, I was walking through a shopping mall near my home, not far from the U.S. Department of Defense headquarters at the Pentagon in Arlington, Virginia. Suddenly, I heard the roar of an airplane flying overhead, followed by a tremendous explosion as the plane flew directly into the Pentagon. It has since occurred to me, had our intelligence agencies been as alert prior to 9/11 as the BMI was in gathering and reporting vital information about the enemy's intentions during the Gettysburg Campaign, and had U.S. authorities acted on that intelligence, that disaster may have been avoided. Keep this tragedy in mind as you hear Lee is Trapped and Must Be Taken, 11 Fateful Days After Gettysburg, July 4th to July 14th, 1863. A groundbreaking study that dissects those fateful days and the importance of the competing armies to both collect information about the enemy's location, strength, and intentions, and act upon that intelligence in a timely manner. Edwin C. Bars, Chief Historian Emeritus, National Park Service. Foreword. This is a deep study about decisions made by Army Commanders Major General George G. Meade of the Army of the Potomac and General Robert E. Lee of the Army of Northern Virginia during the aftermath of the Battle of Gettysburg in July 1863. General Meade had won a great victory over Lee at Gettysburg, July 1st to 3rd, 1863, And now the Confederate commander faced the exceedingly difficult job of withdrawing his battered army from the battlefield and southward across the Potomac River with as little additional loss as possible. Meade had to decide what his next steps would be in wake of his victory. The retreat was unique in many ways. The trek to the Potomac was more than 40 miles. Every day from July 4th to July 14th witnessed small unit actions and battles, including the fight at Monterey Pass in South Mountain on July 4th and 5th. There, Major General Hugh Judson Kilpatrick's Union cavalry attacked the advance of the Army of Northern Virginia. Kilpatrick suffered more than 40 casualties, and the Confederates lost in excess of 1,500, most of them taken prisoner. The clash sparked a chain of actions north of the Potomac over several days. On July 6th, Confederate Major General James Ewell Brown, Jeb Stuart's troopers, secured Hagerstown. This was an extremely important development because whoever held Hagerstown controlled the major routes to the Potomac. A battle unfolded there that was atypical of those fought during the Civil War. For much of the day, troopers, mostly cavalry, roamed up and down the streets fighting mounted and dismounted. Several times local civilians took up arms to fight alongside their favored side. Kilpatrick retreated back to Boonesboro and linked up with Brigadier General John Buford's cavalry division in an attempt to capture Williamsport, the site of several fords across the swollen Potomac. Confederate Brigadier General John M. Bowden and his cavalry brigade guarded a Confederate wagon train with about 10,000 wounded, stretching some 17 miles long. At Williamsport, in a desperate attempt to hold off Union cavalry under Buford and Kilpatrick, M. Bowden threw together a pickup team of diverse commands that included his own brigade, Maryland Cavalry, and diverse infantry units that had been left behind to guard Lee's supply lines on the Virginia side of the river. Imboden even armed his teamsters as he formed a crescent-shaped defensive line around Williamsport. Holding it was critical to the survival of the Virginia Army. On July 7th, the opposing cavalry clashed at Funkstown, and on July 8th, Stuart struck Buford's and Kilpatrick's troopers in the fields north of Boonesboro with his entire division in an attempt to buy more time to help Lee's army to escape. The retreat is a compelling story. Jeb Stuart's cavalry division had an opportunity to prove their skill at both the tactical and operational levels. At the same time, Union cavalry came of age, sparring with rebel troopers and harassing Lee's exhausted columns. It is obvious just how important General Lee's retreat from Gettysburg was, but for more than a century, it was a mere footnote in the literature. One of the first attempts to seriously study the retreat in its entirety was Edwin Coddington's Gettysburg, A Study in Command, 1968. Coddington's final chapter offers context to the retreat in what was likely the first real effort to do so. The first book-length study of the retreat, however, was not written until 1978 with John Schilt's Roads from Gettysburg, which included first-hand accounts and human interest stories told by soldiers who wore both the blue and the gray, as well as civilians. In 1999, I had the honor to serve as guest editor for a special edition of North and South magazine on the retreat from Gettysburg. I wrote the lead article, 10 Days in July, an overview of the entire retreat. This issue went beyond Coddington by providing more detail on the tactical and operational aspects of those critical days. In 2005, Kent Masterson Brown's Retreat from Gettysburg, Lee, Logistics, and the Pennsylvania Campaign appeared. Brown spent years researching into collections that had never been used. Its major strength is its focus on the campaign's logistics, though Brown also has a firm grasp on the operational aspects. 3 years later, Eric Wittenberg, J.D. Petruzzi, and Michael Nugent came out with One Continuous Fight, The Retreat from Gettysburg, and The Pursuit of Lee's Army of Northern Virginia, July 4th to 14th. This excellent study was the first to fully grasp the tactical aspects of the retreat, and features a driving tour, so listeners can trek on their own in the footsteps of the blue and gray. Lee's retreat was gaining interest with scholars. Enter Tom Ryan and Rick Shouse with Lee is Trapped and Must Be Taken, 11 Fateful Days After Gettysburg, July 4th to July 14th, 1863. This study is essential listening for students of the campaign. Ryan, a veteran of more than 30 years in intelligence work with the U.S. Army and Department of Defense, provides cutting-edge analysis of the retreat's operational aspects. Rick Shouse is a retired U.S. Army Sergeant Major who served in military intelligence assignments for more than 3 decades. Together, they have written the most important book on the operational and intelligence level of the retreat from Gettysburg that exists today. The bibliography reveals a galaxy of sources, rare books and articles, and seldom referenced collections from an extensive variety of repositories. A major and seldom used collection that undergirds much of the text is Army of the Potomac, Bureau of Military Information, BMI files at the National Archives. Using this and other collections, the authors tracked many Union spies and scouts working behind Confederate lines under the direction of the Colonel General H. Sharp, who led Meade's intelligence staff. This included operatives such as Sergeant Milton Klein, in my opinion, a Civil War period James Bond, who was active in covert operations that included disguising himself in a Confederate uniform, an act that would have resulted in his summary execution had he been captured. The authors also highlight the plight of some 4,000 Union prisoners forced to take part in the march back to Virginia. The POWs suffered from hunger and dehydration during the arduous trek. According to Captain William Porter Witkin, one of Kilpatrick's troopers captured at Hagerstown on July 6th, from that point on, food and drink was only available at irregular intervals. Ryan and Shouse also consider how local authorities and residents coped with the overwhelming aftermath of the battle in the small town of Gettysburg, and document the attentiveness and concern in communities across the country regarding the outcome of the battle in south-central Pennsylvania, and subsequent events as the armies trekked back toward the Potomac. The primary focus of this work, however, is on the decisions made by the opposing commanders, including Lee's efforts to maneuver under adverse conditions and communicate with the Confederate High Command in Richmond, and Meade's decision-making during the critical period after Gettysburg, especially regarding the Union Army commander's use and/or misuse of timely intelligence that Colonel Sharp's BMI provided to him during these critical days. This book is unique in many respects and expands the historiography of the post-Gettysburg period while providing a comprehensive understanding of the factors that led to decisions made under considerable duress by the respective Army commanders. Congratulations to Tom Ryan and Rick Shouse for producing a masterpiece of scholarship. Ted Alexander, historian, retired. Antietam National Battlefield. Preface. Despite the publication of tens of thousands of books and scholarly articles, many important events of the Civil War have not received as much attention as they deserve. One of them is the immediate aftermath of the Battle of Gettysburg. President Abraham Lincoln and other authorities in Washington envisaged that the rebellion could be brought to an end after the Gettysburg victory if Meade pursued and crushed Lee's retreating army before it escaped across the Potomac River. This study evaluates how the Union commanding general marshaled his forces and employed the information he received from his intelligence staff, the Bureau of Military Information, BMI, during this complex contest with Lee. Our objective is to examine Meade's strategy and tactics, as well as his responsiveness to the desires and dictates of the Union authorities in the nation's capital. Unlike Lee, who had been at the head of the Army of Northern Virginia for a full year prior to undertaking the expedition into the North in early June 1863, Meade received an appointment to take command of the Army of the Potomac only 3 days before engaging in battle against Lee at Gettysburg. Meade had commanded combat troops about the same length of time as Lee. The primary difference between the two officers was that Lee's initial combat command was at the Army level, while Meade started out leading a brigade, then a division, and eventually a corps. Experience at lower levels afforded Meade valuable perspectives that Lee never acquired, and especially first-hand knowledge of small unit operations. At the same time, command of the Army level required special characteristics few generals possessed or exhibited during the Civil War. While Meade demonstrated certain of these qualities fighting on the defensive at Gettysburg, it remained to be seen how he would perform on the offensive in pursuit of the retreating but still very dangerous Virginia Army. The 3 days prior to Gettysburg, beginning when Meade assumed command of the Army on June 28th, and the three-day battle itself, were tests of the newly minted Army commander's ability to function under intense pressure while relying almost exclusively on his own judgment and expertise. Meade proved he was up to the task, and mirrored the high standard Lee set in his first true role as Army commander during 7 days' battles on the Virginia Peninsula, June 25th to July 1st, 1862, where he defeated Major General George B. McClellan and drove his army away from the southern capital and back to the James River. Lee is trapped and must be destroyed is a sequel to Spies, Scouts, and Secrets in the Gettysburg Campaign, how the critical role of intelligence impacted the outcome of Lee's invasion of the North, June to July 1863, which set forth the story of Lee's expedition into the North and the eventual confrontation between two armies at Gettysburg in south-central Pennsylvania. Among other things, that study demonstrated how hard it was for Lee to maneuver his Army of Northern Virginia effectively without the services of Major General James Ewell Brown, Jeb Stuart, and his cavalry division, Lee's principal intelligence-gathering component. The separation was the result of actions taken by Major General Joseph Hooker, the commander of the Army of the Potomac at that time, in response to intelligence he received regarding the movement of Lee's army. The Union moves ended up separating Stuart from the main Confederate army at a critical time. Lee later acknowledged that Stuart's absence much embarrassed, that is, handicapped, his efforts at Gettysburg. Conversely, Meade's intelligence staff, the BMI, under Colonel George H. Sharp, kept him very well informed about the location, strength, and intentions of Lee's army. Sharp's reports impacted subsequent events, and in particular the fighting on July 3rd. As will be seen in the forthcoming analysis contained in this book, the intelligence resources of both armies were active in the aftermath of Gettysburg. A battle of wits raged during those 11 fateful days to determine which commander understood and would properly apply the information he received to gain the advantage over his opponent. Thomas J. Ryan, Bethany Beach, Delaware. Richard R. Schaus, Capon Springs, West Virginia. Introduction. The commander of the Army of the Potomac's 5th Corps, Major General George G. Meade, was rudely awakened in his tent at 3 a.m. on the morning of June 28, 1863. The Union Army was in the vicinity of Frederick, Maryland, and had spent the last 3 days crossing north over the Potomac River from Virginia in pursuit of General Robert E. Lee's Army of Northern Virginia, which was understood to be marching through Maryland and Pennsylvania. Unbeknownst to Meade and the Army's other senior officers, their commander, Major General Joseph Hooker had sent a request to General-in-Chief Henry Halleck in Washington that I may at once be relieved from the position I occupy. Halleck and Hooker were at loggerheads over the disposition of nearly 10,000 troops manning an outpost at Harper's Ferry. Hooker wanted them incorporated into his army. Halleck denied his request. Hooker was also exhibiting signs of stress under the burden of confronting Lee's army again after being soundly defeated at the Battle of Chancellorsville in early May. Provost Marshal Marcinaw Patrick, whose organization was responsible for providing intelligence about the enemy, noted Hooker's recent erratic behavior in his diary and summed up the situation in uncompromising language. "We get accurate information, but Hooker will not use it, and insults all who differ from him in opinion. He has declared that the enemy are over 100,000 strong. It is his only salvation to make it appear that the enemy's forces are larger than his own, which is all false, and he knows it," wrote the frustrated Patrick. "He knows that Lee is his master, and is afraid to meet him in fair battle." The task of rousing Meade out of bed at that early hour fell to Lieutenant Colonel James A. Hardy, the messenger of Secretary of War Edwin Stanton and General Halleck. The first words from his mouth startled Meade. "I have come to give you trouble." The general thought he was being relieved of duty or being placed under arrest. Neither possibility was out of the question. Hooker and Meade had been engaged in open war over whether Meade had voted to withdraw the army back across the Rappahannock River at Chancellorsville. Instead of being relieved or arrested, however, Hardy delivered a letter appointing Meade as the new commander of the Army of the Potomac. Hardy, who had traveled by train from Washington in civilian clothes to maintain secrecy, continued in his awkward assignment of a lower-ranking officer engineering a sensitive transfer of power by accompanying Meade to Hooker's headquarters. The commotion awakened Meade's staff aides. One of them was Meade's son, Captain George Meade, whose father told him to come along. The little party, Meade, son George, and Hardy, rode silently along, the conversation almost restricted to a few questions asked by General Meade, who seemed deeply absorbed in his own thoughts, until, recalled the young captain, headquarters being reached just after daylight, he was ushered into the tent of General Hooker, who was apparently ready to receive him. Hooker, who knew, or at least suspected, that he had lost the confidence of the Union hierarchy in the Capitol, accepted the change of command graciously. The turnover went forward without fanfare, and Hooker briefed Meade on the current situation. Captain Meade, who had waited outside unaware of what was taking place in Hooker's tent, related what happened next. The interview between Generals Hooker and Meade lasted for some time, when the latter issued from the tent and called to me, his aide, with a familiar twinkle of the eye, denoting the anticipation of surprise at information to be imparted. He at last quietly said, "Well, George, I am in command of the Army of the Potomac." Lieutenant Colonel Hardy, who had fulfilled the most important part of his uncomfortable responsibility, wired Halleck, who, along with President Abraham Lincoln and Stanton, eagerly awaited the outcome. "I have accomplished my mission." Before taking his leave from the army, Hooker wrote a farewell note to the troops. General Orders No. 66 exhibited no sign of past disagreement with his successor. "In conformity with the orders, I relinquish the command of the Army of the Potomac. It is transferred to Major General George G. Meade, a brave and accomplished officer, who has nobly earned the confidence and esteem of this army on many a well-fought field." Hooker acknowledged that his usefulness as the commander of the Army of the Potomac is impaired, but was confident that the courage and devotion of this army will yield to my successor a willing and hearty support. Once that message was released to the troops, Hardy telegraphed Halleck that the formal issue of the order of the late commander had been made, and that he had taken the pulse of the feeling and internal condition of the army. Hardy's conclusion was there was cause for satisfaction, and he was returning to headquarters that night. Meade's advancement, especially when considering that only 1 year earlier he was leading a brigade of Pennsylvania reserves, was rather dramatic. The new army commander had little time to contemplate or celebrate what had just occurred. 4 hours after receiving this unanticipated news, he responded to Halleck that he would obey his directive to the utmost of my ability. Even after Hooker debriefed him prior to his departure, Meade remained concerned that he lacked knowledge of the exact condition of the troops and the whereabouts of the enemy. He planned to move his troops toward the Susquehanna River, while keeping Washington and Baltimore well covered, as specified in the orders he had received that morning. Halleck's message appointing Meade spelled out the Lincoln administration's expectations of the new Army of the Potomac commander. You will not be hampered by any minute instructions from these headquarters. Your army is free to act as you may deem proper under the circumstances as they arise. You will, however, keep in view the important fact that the Army of the Potomac is the covering army of Washington, as well as the army of operation against the invading forces of the rebels. You will, therefore, maneuver and fight in such a manner as to cover the capital and also Baltimore, as far as circumstances will admit. Should General Lee move upon either of these places, it is expected that you will either anticipate him or arrive with him so as to give him battle. This twofold requirement, engage Lee while protecting the capital and Baltimore, as far as circumstances will admit, would lead to some differentiation between Meade and President Lincoln over its interpretation. Once he acknowledged his appointment, Meade issued General Orders No. 67 to inform the officers and men of the Army that the President had appointed him to replace Hooker. He spelled out the situation as he understood it. The country looks to this Army to relieve it from the devastation and disgrace of a hostile invasion, he explained. Whatever fatigues and sacrifices we may be called upon to undergo, let us have in view constantly the magnitude of the interests involved, and let each man determine to do his duty, leaving to an all-commanding providence the decision of the contest. As this story unfolds, it will become evident the new commanding general's depiction of Lee's expedition into the North as a hostile invasion reflected a fundamental difference between his and Lincoln's strategic outlook regarding the military struggle underway in the country. This difference would soon manifest itself in the planning and execution of the Army's operations. Meade redirected the Army of the Potomac after news arrived that Lee's army was concentrating about 40 miles east of the Susquehanna River, just north of the Maryland line. The new Army commander had sent two brigades of Brigadier General John Buford's Cavalry Division northward on a scouting mission. When they arrived in a small town named Gettysburg on June 30th, elements of Lee's army were discovered descending on that area from three directions. Meade ordered two of his seven Army Corps, 1st Corps and 11th Corps, to march to Gettysburg. Both corps moved to the vicinity of Emmitsburg, Maryland, with Major General John Reynolds in command of Meade's left wing, 1st, 3rd, and 11th Corps. Buford's report prompted Reynolds to march to Gettysburg with dispatch, with his own 1st Corps in the lead, followed by Major General Oliver O. Howard's 11th Corps. The cavalry was fighting a delaying action on the ridges west of town when 1st Corps arrived. Reynolds hurried the men cross-country to confront the leading elements of Confederate Lieutenant General A.P. Hill's 3rd Corps. Soon thereafter, advance elements of Lieutenant General Richard Ewell's 2nd Corps were discovered coming in from the north. Howard's 11th Corps men rushed through town and deployed to meet Ewell. So began the consequential battle at Gettysburg on the morning of July 1st. In order to understand Meade and Lee as Army commanders, it is important to examine their backgrounds and experience level. Meade assumed control of the Army of the Potomac on only 3 days before a major battle. He had 2 years of command and combat experience at the brigade, division, and corps level. Lee assumed command of the
Sample complete. Ready to continue?